I'm now delighted to be joined by two of UCEM's independent trustees. First of all, Misa von Tunzelmann, who is Head of Corporate Affairs and Marketing Europe at real estate and investment group Lendlease. Hi, Misa.
Hi.
And secondly, Chris Costigan, who is University Secretary and Chief Compliance Officer at Digital Media and Design University, Ravensbourne University, London. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Andrew.
So, as you know, this podcast series is marking LGBT plus History Month. It's highlighted both historical and contemporary challenges experienced by members of the LGBTQ plus community. To provide a bit of context before moving on to LGBT plus spaces in London, would you mind sharing with me when you came out?
I suppose for me, Andrew, it would be more a question of saying which time. I came out in the first instance as a teenager. I was very keen to make sure that my family, and particularly my mother, knew that I wasn't straight before I went to university, because I was worried she would think it was a phase that I picked up at university. So I was out from the age of 16, 17 through till when I joined the property industry in 2004, which was just before I turned 30, when I went back into the closet when I came into the industry. And the reason for that was, at the time, it didn't feel entirely safe to be out as a bi woman working in the property industry. Things changed quite a lot during the time that I was in the industry. I became far more involved in D&I, and then found myself coming out to the LGBT group and my colleagues at JLL, and found that actually that was received very positively.
Glad to hear that it was. And Chris, would you be happy to share your story?
Yeah, but for me, Andrew, actually, in comparison to Misa, I deliberately kept it hidden from my family, and so they were actually the last to know. So I came out at about 19 at university, having not come out during the first year. And then it was a kind of gradual coming out to friends, and then some members of my family, then the whole family, until eventually I was, living openly as a gay man in gay relationships and not hiding it from anybody. I'm glad to say that actually, despite my hesitance to come out to people, particularly family, everybody took it very well and was very supportive. So I wish I hadn't waited quite so long.
Thank you both for sharing. I mean, the next question I had was about, was it a gradual thing? And Chris, as you say there, it was a gradual thing. So what reaction did you receive?
I think for me, and actually I did talk to some of my friends before talking to my family members, but I was very keen that my family members knew before university. I think the reaction I had from most people, and this, I'm going back quite a long time now, we're talking about sort of 1990, sort of time. The reaction from my family was very positive. My mother was very supportive, and I think afterwards she told me that it had been quite hard for her to not accept me for who I am, but she was worried about the life that I would have, because at the time there was a lot of discrimination against LGBT people. She never told me that, she never told me that she was worried about that, but that was what was in her mind. I think from a friend's perspective, it was mixed. I had some friends from sort of church youth group that were less positive about it at that time. Other friends, I think it was fine. Coming into the property industry, as I say, I had my sort of second coming out, and that was overwhelmingly positive. It was quite scary at the time, because I think the industry back in 2004 and the early 2000s was not a particularly diverse and open place. And I think people were quite surprised to find this out about me. However, everybody was very supportive. And I found that over the years between then and now, it has become even more open.
And it's good to hear that over time there's been more of that acceptance and welcome to you sharing your true self. And Chris, I think you said that you received a very positive response, which you wait, and you say you wish you'd come out earlier. So is that the general overview, or were there people who were less receptive?
I think it was a positive reaction from everyone, but I was very directed with who I told and when I told them, and it was only when there was that sense of trust. And I think by the time I was kind of generally out, that the friendship group that I had built probably wouldn't have accepted somebody within it who was homophobic. So it kind of became self-selecting almost. I mean, in the work environment, and I think we're going to come to it later, I have been openly out, and I've never perceived any hostility.
And again, that's really good to hear. And there's been lots of challenges brought up throughout this series about people being their true selves and hiding true identity as well. It's even been touched upon in your previous answers there, because next, Misa, I'd like to just ask a little bit more about the property industry. You say you kind of went back in to the closet in 2004 when you joined the property industry. So why was that? And since you have opened up with colleagues within the industry, have you found it a very welcoming environment?
What you have to remember, 2004, though it wasn't that long ago, you know, the world was quite different. You know, we only really got protection from an employment right perspective as LGBT people in 2003, which is, you know, it's quite a big thing. I'm a bi woman. When I joined the industry, I was in an opposite sex relationship, although previous relationships and my friendship groups, etc., had been same sex. So there was less of an immediate imperative for me to be able to talk about my life and my weekends and talk about my sexual orientation. So I felt that because a lot of the wider environment around me, I didn't want to draw attention to this part of myself because it didn't feel like it was going to be well received and that it would be a safe thing to do. I think when eventually I did come out, you know, my life had changed a bit in terms of my life outside of work. I spent a lot of the time when I was in the closet at work worrying that somebody would find out, because the rest of my life was very out. You know, anyone who'd known me from previous jobs would have known that. Thankfully, social media was less of a thing then. But it was a lot of wasted effort, really, hiding this part of me. So I was very lucky. I think I felt, like Chris said, I wished that I'd said it earlier, if I'm honest, because people were very welcoming and very open. Some people were interested. They wanted to know more about it. One thing I noticed was that when I did come out, lots of people then told me about their friends or their siblings or their relatives who were LGBT. And I sort of wished that they'd mentioned them before, because then I might have felt braver to come out myself.
Okay, so it maybe just wasn't part of the discussion initially when you entered the industry. Since you did open up to your colleagues, that's become more of a discussion. And yeah, it's really positive to hear that it's been, you know, well received within the industry. And that, you know, would you say at the moment it is a very accepting place to be an LGBTQ plus person?
I think it's changing. It's becoming more accepting. There's EG does a regular survey on attitudes towards LGBT people in the industry, and it does show there is still a sizable proportion of people who aren't out, who would like to be out. And there are still some stories around the industry that I would like to consign to the history books. But I think things like this, things that are happening around about the industry, organisations like Freehold and Building Equality and Planning Out are now there. There are visible role models out there. So it is changing. I'd like it to, at some point, to be not necessary to come out, that people don't make assumptions about who you are and what you are. But I think we're not quite there yet.
But moving in the right direction, which is pleasing to hear. And yeah, certainly this series has just shown the need for LGBT plus History Month to show what has happened in the past and what steps still need to be taken, and for people not to be complacent about how the LGBTQ plus community is treated in this country. Depending on who you hang around or whatever, you can think that, you know, we're an incredibly open and tolerant country, but it's not necessarily quite there yet in that sense. And yeah, it's been interesting to gain all of these perspectives. And as well as this, you're a champion for diversity and inclusion as a board member for Eastside Young Leaders Academy, a Newham-based organisation working with young, predominantly black people, which seeks to create leaders of character and purpose for tomorrow's world, drawn from those most in need in grassroots communities. You were a founder member of the Steering Committee for Changing the Face of Property, an initiative which aims to increase diversity and inclusion in the industry. And in addition to this, you're a board member of Freehold, the property industry LGBT network, which previous interviewee Brian Bickle is also a member and previous board member. And on top of this, you were named on the Financial Times' top 100 outstanding LGBT leaders list in 2015 and 2016, and one of the top 10 most inspiring LGBT leaders at the British LGBT Awards in 2017. So that is quite an impressive CV, and you're clearly very active in the diversity and inclusion space. So what inspires you to take a leadership role in promoting diversity and inclusion, especially with regards to the LGBTQ plus community?
I've always had a strong sense of fairness. I don't like it when things aren't fair. I want the world to be fair. I mean, that's probably the basic reason. Growing up, I'm mixed race. I grew up in a very white town in the south of England in the 1980s. And although I think a lot of people to look at me wouldn't realise I was mixed race, it was, you know, it was very obvious walking around with my family, and I didn't like some of the comments that I got and comments that were made at that time. And I think that started me to be very aware of difference and the importance of inclusion. And I think coming into the industry as a student, I was very involved with inclusion activity and activism. That took a bit of a backseat when I started my career. And then when I found myself in the industry in a relatively senior role, I felt I had an opportunity to make a difference, and it was important to me to do so.
That's a great answer, because at the heart of it, it's fairness. It's treating everybody as you would wish to be treated. When put like that, it's such a simple and obvious thing, but it does need saying, and it does need people like yourself taking a leadership role and striving to gain that fairness within society and within communities. So, Chris, I mean, you earlier mentioned how you've come out within your sector, which is the higher education sector. You've had over 15 years experience in higher education. So how have you found working in the HE sector? And would you say it's always been a welcoming sector for members of the LGBTQ plus community in your experience?
I think I've been quite lucky, actually. So when I started in higher education in 2015, I started with a relatively young higher education organisation that had only begun in 97. And I think when the organisation is young, the staff base will tend to be young as well. And so that helped. One thing that really helped me was that I started at BPP as a law lecturer, and the dean of the law school was openly gay. And that really sets a tone for the organisation, for acceptance, which I certainly felt kind of permeating through the organisation. What that did for me was it meant that, you know, when I came into kind of executive posts, I did want to be visibly and openly gay. You know, so I will talk about my husband. I realise that people on the podcast won't be able to see it, but on this Zoom call in the background, there is a picture of my husband. And to try and kind of break down that barrier and make anybody else who might be in a similar position to me feel welcome. I think thinking about the broader higher education sector, though, I can't speak to it, but I know that Stonewall did a research report into students at HE a few years back, and they found that 42% of students were still hiding their identity because of fear. 60% of trans students and 22% of LGBT students had had negative comments or conducts from other students. 36% of trans students and 7% of LGBT students had had negative comments or conduct from staff. So whilst my own experience has been positive as a staff member, certainly a lot of that, which is still happening in 2018, so 20 years after I was at university, still resonates with me. So I don't think it is yet a place where students feel safe, or on the basis of this report, a place where students are safe.
That is pretty staggering. I've got to say, those stats, you wouldn't imagine it would be anywhere near as high as you were listing there. And certainly, I think this is what this podcast series is really proving, is that, you know, the complacency thing, that my own ignorant perception is that university is a place where people are free to be themselves and is one of the perhaps more progressive parts of our society. And that may be the case, in which case, you know, those stats are even more concerning if the wider society is worse in that respect. So it just does show the need for more education and for people to be more inclusive. Are you involved in any LGBTQ plus groups yourself, Chris?
I'm not at the moment, actually. I have been in the past. So when I was at bar school, I was involved in the bar lesbian and gay group. And I was also a member and at one point chair of an independent advisory group to the Met Police on LGBT issues. So I have been. What I've tended to do now is focus my charitable work in the higher education sector. But I have sat and currently do sit on the EDI committee at my current workplace and did at my previous workplace as well. So trying to kind of be a champion for all aspects of diversity and inclusion, you know, and a visible role model in respect of LGBT inclusion.
Yeah, and it's not for want of getting involved. Again, if you just go on our people section on the UCEM website, there's about 20 different roles, it seems, that you're involving yourself in. So both of you, very busy people. And in addition to everything you're both doing in your sectors and on EDI, you're both trustees at UCEM. So I wanted to quickly ask, you know, what attracted you both to the trustee position at UCEM, and what opportunity exists for UCEM in the equality, diversity and inclusion space? And maybe Misa, if you're happy to go first here as our lead trustee in this area.
Thanks, Andrew. Being a trustee of UCEM is, I mean, it's a great privilege, because it's one of the places where the future of our industry is being created. I was attracted to it because of the way it teaches and the people it teaches. I think it gives people who would otherwise not have an opportunity to go to university the opportunity to go. You know, you're able to learn flexibly, you're able to learn from home. So yes, I know a lot of the students that are attending would be the same demographic as students from other universities, but there is also a sizable proportion of people who are mature students, or combining being an apprenticeship with work, or combining a graduate program with work. So I think that is really interesting. I love the digital model. My day job, I'm a marketer. My entire industry has been disrupted by digital in a beautiful way. So I think it's fascinating how higher education is being disrupted and being delivered in this way. So I find that very interesting and very informative for my day job, if I'm honest. I think in terms of opportunities on EDI, as I said before, the UCEM model enables people to study that would otherwise not be able to study. And I think that's great for them and for us as an industry. I think the opportunity is to talk about it more, is to engage people and prepare people, diverse people, and frankly, the mainstream, for the industry that we want to be tomorrow and the day after tomorrow. And I think I love the fact that you're doing this series. I would love to see more of this sort of thing happening with UCEM. So we're exploring different aspects of diversity and inclusion.
Fantastic. And what would you have anything to add there, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I've come to the board of UCEM from the higher education sector rather than the construction sector. My own reasons for wanting to get involved is I've been involved with kind of young, small specialist organisations that are perhaps new to kind of degree awarding powers, and I felt that this was an organisation that I could add value to, and I hope that during my time I have done. In terms of what do I think UCEM could do in the EDI space, I think it's probably a call I would say to all higher education institutions, and it's around the curriculum. You know, all HEIs are essentially training the future workplace and leaders. So I think if through the curriculum they can demonstrate the value of diversity when it is included in conversations, that could really be kind of having a fundamental impact on how people are treated and whether they are treated equally when they actually get into the workplace, because that new generation will understand its value. So that would be my challenge to UCM and indeed all HEIs.
Yeah, and two different angles you've given there. You've got the curriculum there, Chris, where you're talking about how we're presenting our learning materials to our students. And then MISA, you were talking about, you know, the general marketing itself. And obviously this series, which, yeah, my colleague Eliza White came up with the idea for this. And it's been incredibly eye-opening and interesting. And it just shows, by opening up these discussions, what issues there have been or currently are, and what solutions we can talk about in this area, and to make things better and learn how we can be allies to groups or just become more inclusive in general. Thanks for detailing, you know, some of your personal stories there. It's wonderful that you've been so candid with me today. And as you know, the series, we're talking about LGBT plus spaces in London. So this is mostly commonly referred to with bars and clubs as a refuge for the community. And have you frequented these spaces in the capital? And if so, what do they mean to you? And Misa, if you'd like to go first on this one.
I really want to say no, but that would be a lie. Yes, absolutely. I think when I first moved to London, I was spending an awful lot of time in bars and clubs all around London, actually. Soho, Brixton, I lived in Stoke Newington. There was a number of places up there as well. And they were very much the place that you would go to meet people, to make friends, to be a part of your community. I moved to London in 95. And at the time, you know, there wasn't the internet. You couldn't, you know, there wasn't social media really. Well, there was the internet, but there wasn't, you know, there wasn't places that you could meet people and make friends and find your community there. So you know, those were the places where the community was. It was harder to be openly out in restaurants, bars, clubs generally. So, you know, if I was out with my girlfriend, for example, I would want to be in a place where I could hold hands and not risk violence or discrimination or worse. So it was important from a safety perspective. I think, you know, for me, I have, you know, like most people, very fond memories of spending my 20s in those places and having a great time. And more recently, they're still places that I enjoy going, although there are less of them now.
Hence this episode talking and the series looking at disappearing spaces. Chris, have you gone to the bars and clubs in London before? And do they have a meaning for you as well?
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily say a misspent youth, but certainly a youth that was spent in the bars and clubs of London. I actually moved to Manchester in 2015, so I've got a fair amount of experience in the bars and clubs there as well. But like Misa, I've got incredibly fond memories of them. I think I was a touch after Misa, so I kind of went to London in sort of 2001, but it was the place where you had to go. The internet was still emerging. And as Misa says, you know, I would not have felt comfortable going to, you know, just any old Pizza Express to have dinner with a partner. It had to be the one on Greek Street in Soho, because that's where you felt comfortable. So even though that wasn't a gay space, it was within that space. But, you know, yeah, it was really important. And to be honest, I think it's still relatively important. It wasn't that long ago, probably in the last 12 months, that I was walking along the street with my husband and somebody shouted queer out of the window of a car. So, you know, it still doesn't feel safe to be on the streets.
Again, it's just another reminder of what horrible views people have and that they feel they can say something as hateful as that as well to you and your husband, which is just again staggering, I suppose. I think what we've come to in terms of looking, I think particularly the 80s heyday, which Eliza referred to in our previous episode in Soho, when a lot of the places were, it was a burgeoning scene with the bars and the clubs and very much related to drinking is well, which is potentially not as popular in the current age. You mentioned sort of going there and you're feeling more comfortable. And I think I use the word sort of refuge for the LGBTQ plus community, these spaces. From your personal experience, have you noticed a decline in the numbers of these venues in the capital? Misa, you're still living in London, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. I think that there definitely is a decline. I don't have the stats in front of me, but I know, you know, that's been well documented. I think part of it is actually a byproduct of the fact that it is becoming more open. You know, society is becoming more open. So it is possible now to go to any Pizza Express and not expect homophobia with your garlic bread, which has got to be a good thing. I think, as you say, there are more places to meet people. There are more things to do. Maybe, you know, maybe we're getting to a point where the only entertainment in town is no longer drinking. You know, you can do other things, which is great. I do think it's a shame for us that we have less LGBTQ venues. I think what we're seeing now is some acceptance and some ring fencing with some of those places, and we've seen that with some of the planning decisions that have been made around places like the Vauxhall Tavern, for example, which I know you spoke about on a previous podcast. I think ultimately these places are businesses, so they can only run if they have people to attend to them, and if less people are going, then that they can't run as businesses in that way. I think what we need to do is look at how we, you know, how we redefine LGBTQ space for the 21st century, I suppose, and what the spaces are and how we continue to build that community, you know, in a different way.
And yeah, we're seeking to examine why there is a loss of LGBTQ plus spaces in London. There are fewer than there maybe were 10, 15, 20 years ago. And yeah, you touch upon some good reasons. I mean, there's the general commercial rent issues and that's rising. It's harder to have successful businesses. And Brian Bickle just earlier sort of was discussing some of those issues. You've both also in this episode touched upon the digital spaces and chances to meet people virtually and therefore less of a need to go to a physical space to meet members of the LGBTQ plus community. And also that there is, whilst not perfect, but a more accepting general society out there that you can go to your general, you know, Pizza Express. They're getting a fair bit of airtime in this episode. And
other pizzas are available.
Thank you, Misa. That is the phrase which was definitely needed at that moment. So yeah, you can expect to go to your restaurants, to your other entertainment venues, and not have homophobia chucked in with your garlic bread, which to coin your phrase from earlier as well, Misa. So that seems to be better as society is progressing. Do you have any other reasons? I'll ask Chris, because I think, Misa, you were touching upon these reasons why we are losing more LGBTQ plus venues in the capital, Chris, or do you think that just about covers it?
I would defer to Misa on this. I think she's probably closer to it. I mean, I think there's a general view, and it's anecdotal, I suppose, that there's lots of drinking establishments and other establishments that are finding it a struggle in the capital, and I suppose that LGBTQ spaces would, you know, would naturally have a consequence of that. I think it's a real shame, because I think they are still desperately needed. You know, I think that just a few weeks ago there was that poor young lad that got, you know, beaten around the head in a homophobic attack outside of Heaven. You know, so this does still exist on our streets, and so giving young LGBTQ people and indeed middle-aged LGBTQ people, you know, safe spaces to be themselves is incredibly important. So I hope that we can retain some, even if we lose some.
And again, there was, in Misa's previous answer, there was discussion of some of the protected characteristics of some of these spaces. Obviously, the Royal Vauxhall Tavern is now Grade 2 listed, and it was the first LGBTQ plus space to gain that designation in London. There's the LGBTQ plus museum, which is gaining planning permission, I believe, at the moment, which Queer Britain is leading on. And also the rise of other spaces which are not as typical as what they were in the past. So just as a closer, what future do you think there is for LGBTQ plus spaces in London? And Misa, if you'd like to go first, please.
I think London as a city has adapted and changed over the centuries. There's always been LGBTQ people in London, as there is everywhere, and they've always found places and spaces to meet and be themselves. I think we will continue to adapt as the world adapts. It will be interesting to see how some of these new spaces work out. I'm really excited, for example, about that permanent space for the museum, some broader community places that we can be. So I suppose that's a long way of saying I don't know what the future is, but I'm sure there is a future, and I'm sure it will be beautiful and rainbow tinged as it has been for the last couple of thousand years.
I can tell you work in marketing. That was a lovely phrase, which you seem to be throwing out a lot of really brilliant phrases throughout this podcast. As you say, the adaptation piece is always there, and it is quite a difficult question to answer without a crystal ball in your hand. These places will survive. You know, some of them, maybe not all of the traditional spaces, but new ones are forming, and it's really great to see that the museum is going to cover that history as well. Chris, do you have a view on the future for LGBTQ plus spaces in London?
Yeah, I agree with Misa. I think it's about change and adapting. You know, nothing stays the same and nothing should stay the same. So I think it's about understanding how the LGBT community want to use these spaces, what will benefit them, and adapting it to be that kind of space. I think most industries, and I would include LGBT venues amongst them, are kind of innovative and vibrant spaces. So I think that they will be able to find the solution. I hope that they do. And I will go and support them.
Fantastic. Just want to thank you once again, Misa and Chris, for sharing your experiences with us. It's really been a valuable opportunity. So good that you were able and happy to share your own personal stories and also to provide some insights on the spaces in London and what future may lie ahead. So thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks, Andrew.